Good morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Vincent Gagan in the Politics Department at Queen's University Belfast, and we're discussing Roberto Unger's book, Democracy Realized, A Progressive Alternative. Vincent, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
For those who did not catch the interview with Professor Unger, I wonder if you could begin by giving a brief overview of the book, and particularly highlighting those points that you think are of special interest that we might discuss later in the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an extraordinary book in many ways. When you start reading it, you're realizing you've got what in effect is a piece of grand social theory, nothing less than an anatomy of the world and its ills. And Unger explores it through its political, its sociological, its economic, its legal, educational aspects, such that people who don't have Unger's facility in all these areas can find it quite hard work. The central theme of the book is a search for an alternative to what he sees as the troubling dominance of neoliberalism in the world. He's looking for what he calls a progressive alternative, and he finds the other forms of opposition to neoliberalism inadequate. He finds social democracy, for example, or very technocratic approaches to reform inadequate, in that he sees them merely as trying to mitigate, to humanize, to some extent, neoliberalism. Instead, he wants to have what he sees as a more effective approach, and he calls this approach democratic experimentalism. And this is a very elaborate theoretical political project, broadly divided into two main phases, which in effect is a type of process politics, I suppose. In other words, he wants to sort of change people's ideas and practices in such a way that there's a deepening of democracy, as he sees it, a replacement of certain inadequate forms of democracy with what to him is a deeper form of democracy. And that broadly, that's in effect, broad outlines is the central theme of the book.
Okay, that's a very nice summary. I want to look at the elements of that. One of the first things you mentioned is that he's wanting to find an alternative to what you call the troubling dominance of neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. How briefly would you define neoliberalism for those who might not be familiar with the term? And then what is it that he finds troubling about it?
Neoliberalism is a political economic doctrine which basically is committed to a free market. It wishes to keep the state out of the economy as much as possible. It looks forward to it believes that the whole world should be integrated into one market, and that there'll be a spread of prosperity as a consequence. And it draws, therefore, on traditional liberal notions, classical liberal notions of the 17th and 18th century. Unger finds this problematic because he finds that the neoliberalism doesn't get to grips with the basic gap he sees in modern societies between what he sees as a vanguard and what he sees as a rear guard element in society. The vanguard are the insiders, the people who are the economic beneficiaries of the system. The rear guard people are the people who are, in a sense, kept out of the spread of prosperity. Now, this has a particular problem when you look outside the advanced societies to developing societies, because he believes that that the standard view of globalization is that there is a great mass of capital circulating around the world, available to finance all sorts of projects. Unger argues, and I think rightly, that this is a false picture of globalization. What actually happens in globalization is that very little, relatively little capital leaves its home shores. Most investment capital stays within its national borders, which means there's a relatively little amount of capital available for investment in other places. So that as a consequence of this, many developing societies have to restructure their entire political and economic systems to attract this rather scarce investment capital. And the result is you get very high interest rates, you get large elements of unemployment. And as a consequence of that, the economies begin to decline. And he points to the experience of Argentina, for example. So the basic problem is that neoliberalism, although it benefits certain privileged sectors in both the advanced and in the developing world, does so at the expense of the overwhelming majority of people, particularly, as say, in developing societies.
He criticizes, you said, social democracy, and some people might construe that as meaning that somehow he's anti-democratic.
Uh-huh.
But as you mentioned later, if anything, he's for what he calls deepening a democracy, and perhaps one of the ways of understanding the idea of deepening democracy is that the people who are not as well off will be better off, not only economically better off, but politically better off under the sort of system he envisions. Is that what he's after? Is that what he might mean by deepening democracy?
Yeah, I mean, to take your initial point, he's critical of certain forms of democracy. He's critical, for example, of, and he's quite explicit in this, of certain forms of American constitutionalism, the notion of the checks and balances and so forth. He's critical also of various forms of European parliamentarianism, because he sees these forms as slow forms. They blunt the political edge. They're not very responsive forms. That in effect, that these types of systems allow, it's like power brokers, elites, to effectively dominate policy. So there's that aspect. And one consequence of that is that people become very alienated from conventional democratic politics and begin to think it's really not worth taking part because there's not much to be achieved. And therefore you get this process of skepticism, cynicism, and people retreat to what he sees as the private sphere. And therefore what he wants to do is, it's sort of like a twofold approach. He wants to introduce more responsive, more effective forms of democratic institution. And he wants to introduce democracy into areas which are often seen as, in some sense, private and non-political. So, for example, in schools and in corporations and so forth, so that people begin to think of democracy as action and a whole series of fronts. And in this way, he believes, people will begin to see there is actually something valuable, something important in democratic participation. And this in turn will then pay off in terms of greater participation, greater interest in the grand politics of society. And certainly if you look at figures for participation in elections, for example, I don't know precisely what they are in the States, but certainly in Western Europe, you do find levels of participation have decreased over time. You know, people are staying away. It does seem to be, people do seem to be turned off politics. So he's trying to sort of get rid of what is a rather narrow definition of politics and a rather narrow definition of democracy, both of which are concerned with grand politics, with voting and so forth. He wants much more to see the political in a whole series of aspects, and the democratic being more than merely voting for a candidate in periodic elections. In that sense, I mean, he has some affinity with earlier theories of participation, participatory politics, that if you participated, you grew as an individual, you became more interested in matters of politics, you became more thoughtful, and so forth.
What does he mean by democratic experimentalism? And if you could give a brief outline of that, then we can go back and look at the elements of your answer.
Difficult to know where to start because it's such a sort of rather complicated concept. He believes that the way people view the world is in many ways a product of the particular range of institutions in the society. So that people, perceive certain things as natural, as inevitable, and so forth, and think that's the way it is, that's the way it will always be.
And his view is if you begin to shift, so that in other words, that if you begin to move in a political process, then you'll begin to get new perceptions of things. So he argues that people will begin to form new visions of what's possible. They'll arrive at a place they never thought they would arrive at if they'd looked at it in their initial position. So he's a great believer that processes change people's views and perceptions. And therefore, the democratic experimental project is an attempt to try and alter the particular institutional balance in society such that people begin to develop new perspectives that they wouldn't have originally thought of.
I wonder, too, if you could say a little bit more about the influence of institutions that uh-huh. he sees, why he sees that as so very important in understanding both our current predicament and understanding where we might go.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a very broad definition of institutions. I mean, it's not simply political parties or structures of government, but also economic organizations. I mean, if we're trying to look, perhaps situate Unger in terms of certain theoretical traditions, I mean, the people that spring to mind are people like Hobbes or Marx. These were people who argued that if people find themselves in certain contexts, certain forms of behavior seem more rational than others, more logical. So in the case of Hobbes, for example, he speculates, what would society be like without a state or without other social institutions? His argument was that people would seek to preserve themselves above all else. So there's a logic there. And the way people would do that, they would find, is they would have to do preemptive strikes. Otherwise, you know, they might be killed. So people like Hobbes argue that there's a logic to particular institutional forms, but this logic is self-defeating. And similar in the case of Marx, who argues the desire for prosperity in capitalist conditions is self-defeating. But people still feel that they have to go down this road. Same with Unger. He believes that the current logic of the world is such that people feel certain approaches, particularly the neoliberal approach, is the rational one, and therefore that they engage in this sort of activity, but find very often that it's self-defeating, it doesn't help them either. And therefore what he wants is he feels he should have to wrench people out and of this logic, of this commitment to this type of logic, and he wants to try and persuade people to think, if you like, outside the box, to think, is an alternative logic. And he hopes that what will happen is that people will begin to develop, if you like, an alternative logic, a logic which is compelling, but which isn't self-defeating. In other words, they will change their approach to life, their approach to economic activity, and so forth. And as a process, as a consequence, they will develop strategies which actually do bear fruit, which do not contradict themselves in the way that they do at the moment.
This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Vincent Gagan, professor of politics at Queen's University Belfast, and we're discussing Roberto Unger's book, Democracy Realized. If you were going to identify some of the central elements of change that he would like to see in place, at least beginning to bring about the kind of democratic experimentalism which he envisions, what would some of those most important changes be?
Right. He's very keen on the state. One of his, I suppose, criticisms of globalization is that one of the tendencies of globalization theory is to minimize the importance of the state, to argue that basically states are powerless and that it is these sort of movements of capital which determine economic and political policy. He's a great believer that the state can be a powerful instrument in a genuine democratic politics. But he says it's got to be what he calls a hard state, which is, you know, slightly sinister, but he doesn't mean it in that way. He distinguishes a hard state from an authoritarian state. What he means by a hard state is a state that actually can get things done, on the one hand, and a state which is responsive to the interests of the population on the other. Hence his dislike of American constitutionalism in its current form, in that he believes that the notion of checks and balances and so forth mean that the state isn't hard in the way that he wants it to be. Similarly, he believes it's not therefore entirely responsive to people. So what he envisages, therefore, is an attempt to combine a hard state, which is responsive. So that's an important element in it, this need for an effective state. He also speculates about the need for a rethink of property rights, for example. He thinks that the neoliberal program, given its liberal roots, is very committed to a rather strict definition of private property, that there is only one type of private property, which is one person owns something. And he wants to try and spread ownership, various forms of stakeholding and so forth, so that people have, lots of people have a stake and have a connection to property. He wants to see changes in schooling practices, for example. He wants schools to encourage adventurous thinking. He talks about creating a society of prophets, people who feel that they can anticipate the future, think about the future, and so forth. He has a whole series of economic reforms, trying to create institutions which will generate venture capital to allow people lower down the social spectrum to generate economic units and so forth. And his approach is to try, he's a believer in actual, in what you might call, he calls radical reform, which is that you can, you attack various bits of the current system and you try and introduce reform in a whole variety of areas. So it's a sort of multi-front approach in all these areas, like the economy, the state, the school, and so forth. He believes that people should try and start introducing these sorts of this more open, this what he calls collective learning, as he sees it, to build up a notion of community and collective learning, and therefore a sort of a form of empowerment of people in these institutions to overcome what he sees as traditional relationships of dominance and dominated. He wants to try and, in all these fronts, try to democratize in the strong sense that he means that.
I want to ask you just about a couple of those, and then I want to move on to look at a last theme or two during the interview. One of the things you mentioned is this idea of a hard state. And I thought myself in reading the book that the term was perhaps inappropriate or unfortunate in that it might imply authoritarianism. But I take it that what he's really wanting to emphasize when he talks about a hard state is a state that is willing to do battle against the elites, and therefore to be responsive to the mass of the citizens in the country, that he apparently thinks that in most countries, even most democratic countries, that there are certain elites, especially moneyed elites, who have inordinate control not only over economic life but over political life, and that one of the things that a hard government has to do is say no to those people. Is that your understanding and reading as well?
It is, yeah. I agree with you. I think that word hard invites misapprehensions, misinterpretations. It's more a notion of effective, a state that can be effective in terms of a particular project, which is, as we know, is a normative one of democracy. And when he does speculate about what a political system would look like, which he does towards the end of the book, he talks about the need for this hard state, but also the need for relatively frequent plebiscites. That, in other words, he thinks that there has to be popular decisions on specific issues. And as you know, the word plebiscite, from the Latin word plebs, you know, the common people, shows to some extent why he sees plebiscites as a sort of radical instrument. It's a way in which, you know, there can be a direct popular input into issues. So he wants to try and combine, you know, this hard state, which can do the things he wants, which, as you say, is to stand up to economic interests. But not just to economic interests in terms of the wealthy. He believes the state also needs to be hard occasionally to less affluent people. You know, the state is in some sense the guardian of the society, and therefore it may have to take hard decisions from people who aren't pulling their weight, and so forth. It's not just an instrument for, you know, for making sure that economic elites don't abuse the power. It's an instrument whereby the society makes sure that nobody abuses their position.
And that's one of the many ways in which the book is a very interesting mix, that he says some things that might appear to be more left, in line with leftish thinking, but he also says things that might be more in line with rightish thinking. I mean, your terminology earlier, that what he wants to do is to expand venture capital, certainly sounds like one of the considerations that someone more conservative might advocate.
Yeah, so you. I mean, he's interesting in that respect, in that one part of his project is that he actually tries to resurrect concepts which traditionally the left has not been entirely happy with. So, for example, he does talk about the need for rights, for example, a different theory of rights, but rights nonetheless. He's happy to talk about nations, again, something which the left has been traditionally hostile to, or many on the left have been hostile to. His term, his category is democracy, not socialism. He sees himself as in some sense transcending the old right-left debate. He talks about, you know, it's no longer like public-private, free markets versus controlled markets, these sorts of things. He thinks that these debates are these conflicts, these dualisms, are a product of an age which was, in a sense, moved beyond. And yes, I mean, you find elements in his thinking which people on the right might find appealing. I mean, for example, he is very sensitive, for example, to the religious heritage of society. I mean, he quotes on a number of occasions material from the Bible to illustrate his point. In his radicalism, in so far as he is a radical, and I think it's true to say that he is a radical, in some ways grows out of traditional leftist approaches, but does it in a way which, in a sense, generates a dialogue with very different currents of thinking, currents of thinking which we do, some extent, we associate with currents on the right.
All right. I wonder if we could talk about, going back to this idea that it's a grand theory that he's offering. And in fact, some people might well say, well, yeah, okay, this sounds nice, but it's just too utopian. Is it utopian? And if it is that a criticism of the theory in any way?
Not to me. I'm a great fan of utopian thinking, but the term itself is ambiguous. He's aware himself that there are things which are simply impossible. Utopian, and that is the sense of utopian in which he would reject. You know, nobody wants to engage in policies which are simply ridiculous or which require a human nature which is inconceivable. But there is a sense of the word utopian which implies more the notion of something which is visionary, or that one has thought through an alternative to the present. And it's that type of, in that sense, I would call him a utopian. I mean, he makes the point that, you know, how are you going to move from the grip of history, because he's aware in a way in which people are, can often be imprisoned by attitudes, opinions generated from the past. And therefore he thinks it's not simply a matter of, you know, cold analysis, but actually people need to think, you know, differently. What would it be like if? Wouldn't it be better if? And he thinks there's actually no way into the future, you know, unless you're prepared to use your imagination to project what's possible, to talk about what would a society like be based on different values to the one which are dominant at the moment. He prefers the term prophet or prophecy, not in the sense that we often use it to imply predicting the future, but perhaps more in the sense of the sort of biblical concept of the term. The prophets were people who said, this is the way forward, or this is, you know, this is God's wish, and so forth, to make people think and to move in the right sorts of direction, not a notion that this is going to happen. So there's a lot in the work in that sort of way. And he tries to, if you like, break down the old realism-utopianism distinction. That's a commonplace to say that utopians are unrealistic and realists are unutopian. His argument is that given the predicament we're in the modern world, there has to be some pretty adventurous thinking if we are to get out of these problems. At one point he says, in order to become realists, we have to be visionary. That, in other words, it's not that the two are in an antagonistic relationship, but that, if you like, a certain form of realism, all that is a form of fatalism or a form of conservative commitment to the present. So it's, if you like, a visionary realism, which says, given, you know, what we've got at the moment, given the potentialities, given what our values are, how can we conceive of something which is better than we've got at the moment? And in no way does he imply, at one point in the book, he says, you know, this does not imply some belief that human nature is going to be radically restructured in any way, which is sometimes the claim made against utopian thinking, that they assume a completely transformed human nature. He says you can't do that. What you can do, though, is given what you know about humans and what you think they are capable of, it is possible, given the right encouragement and the right context, for everybody to think, you know, wouldn't it be better if we did this? And to dialogue with people. So you begin to get strategies based upon visions developing. And I find that, you know, I don't find that a problematic approach. It seems to me that's utopianism in the best sense of the word.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Vincent Gagan, professor of politics at Queen's University Belfast. We've been discussing Roberto Unger's book, Democracy Realized. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.